Some people are born with an activist's instinct. Others are born with a gift of communication, and still others are born with a comedian's timing. It's rare to meet someone who has all three. Ben Wickler does. Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. At his core, I think Ben Wickler is someone who believes in his own agency and in the agency of the people around him. It seems that he simply cannot look at a broken system without asking, how do we organize to fix it? Ben and I grew up down the street from one another on the near west side of Madison, Wisconsin. His parents taught at the university, and he was raised in that distinctive mix of progressive politics, civic engagement, and academic inquiry that has shaped generations of Madisonians. Madison was also the birthplace of The Onion, where a particular strain of absurdist humor found its voice before making its way into the mainstream through shows like The Daily Show and The Colbert Report. Although Ben is a few years younger than I am, I remember him as the kid who seemed to be organizing everything. He started an alternative newspaper in high school, led walkouts and protests, and had an unusual ability to persuade his classmates that they could accomplish more together than they could alone. That instinct has never really left him. Ben's career has moved back and forth between communication and organizing, often bringing the two together. He got his professional start working for Al Franken, first as a researcher and a writer, then as a producer on Air America Radio. He later worked on political campaigns and held leadership roles at organizations including Move On, Avaaz, and Change.org. Along the way, he hosted political podcasts. He lived in Cambridge, Mass., Brooklyn, New York, and Washington, D.C., before eventually returning home to Madison to become chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. Talking with Ben, I come back again and again to the role that humor has played throughout his life. Humor in his world is not merely decoration, it's the infrastructure. He's not arguing for politics to be more entertaining. He's funny because to him, comedy creates community, and community is how people find the confidence to act together. I recently visited Ben at the house where he grew up in Madison and where he and his wife are now raising their own family. We spent as much time talking about Madison as we did about politics. He speaks about Wisconsin with the affection of someone who believes that a place can shape the way people see the world. And the tradition known as the Wisconsin idea, the belief that knowledge should serve the public good, runs through almost everything he says. Ben's new book, This is the Plan, How to End America's Meltdown and Save Democracy, draws heavily on that experience. In his telling, Wisconsin has spent the last decade wrestling with many of the same political forces that have ultimately reshaped the country at large. He sees plenty of reasons for concern, but also plenty of reasons to keep working. After spending time with Ben, it is tempting to describe him as an optimist. I think disciplined is maybe closer to the truth. He doesn't suggest that everything will work out. Things can get worse, he says, but they can also get better. The outcome depends on what people choose to do together. Earlier this week at a Brooklyn event celebrating the publication of his book, the political organizer and friend of Ben's, Elise Hoag, referred to him as the happy warrior. It struck me as exactly right. He doesn't approach politics with outrage as his organizing principle. He talks about democracy as something collaborative. He sounds curious rather than furious. And faced with a difficult problem, his instinct is to gather people, understand what's happening, and figure out how to move forward. Whether or not you share Ben's politics, I think there's something more universal in that disposition. His belief in collaboration, civic life, and community reaches beyond any party affiliation. And the line from our conversation that stays with me isn't really a political statement so much as it is an observation about how people endure difficult work together. Democracy is exhausting, he tells me, until you discover solidarity. Great organizers are often described as energetic. But listening to Ben, I came away thinking that for him, the energy comes from the organizing. Third-story.com is the place to sign up and subscribe. Visit the archive. It's hundreds of deep dives like this one, many over the years that were done during my annual pilgrimages to Madison, including conversations with David Marinus, Richie Davidson, Michael Feldman, Mary Sweeney, and many with my dad. There are also other episodes with friends and former associates of Ben Wickler's like Peter Keckley and Dan Pashman, and there's even a 2018 panel discussion with Ben Wickler alongside political strategist Anat Shenker Osorio and writer Dan Kaufman about the impact on all of them of growing up in Madison. Visit the Substack for all the latest writings and musings. It's leosidran.substack.com. And remember that we are made in partnership with WBGO Studios. Visit wbgo.org/studios for more of their award-winning content. Here's me and Ben Wickler talking it down.
Yeah, it's either right here or right there is probably
better. Yeah, this is great.
Okay. Nice little hum, but...
Yeah, that's okay.
Then it'll come out in post.
I think, yeah, it'll come out in post. Ben Wickler, hearing you say things like it'll come out in post reminds me that you were an early adopter in the radio and podcasting space, too.
Maybe too early in retrospect.
Yeah, well, as a podcaster, you had your moment, I feel like. And it was a big part of your... Well,
my first job out of college was producing the Al Franken show on Air America Radio. So I was Al's first hire on the show and got to work with him. And then Billy Kimball, who was this legendary comedy writer, became the executive producer, and Jim Norton and Andy Barr and a bunch of really interesting, talented people at this attempt to create a progressive counter to right-wing talk radio, which was quite successful. In its way, it very quickly built a big audience, but it was a business disaster. And so there's like a documentary about it. There's the people who put in the initial investment turned out to be crooks, and the money disappeared that went off the air within 3 days in some of the big cities where it was on the air. And there was like this huge roller coaster, but it was incredibly fun. And I got to write comedy for like Tina Fey and a bunch of my kind of comedy heroes, and book all my heroes in the progressive movement on the show. So for 2 years, I was doing that with the Al Franken show team at Air America, and I started having ideas about if I ever did my own show, what would I do? And then fast forward to 2011, I got a radio show on a little progressive station in DC, which I called the Flaming Sword of Justice, and it was all stories of fights for good and justice. And that was like a weekly hobby. But then It became my full-time job. MoveOn sponsored it, and I relaunched it as The Good Fight. And so we had this moment. We had 3 days where we were the number one podcast on iTunes and built a subscribership and all this stuff. But it was before podcasts exploded in terms of listenership. And there was not really a good business model at that time, or at least not one that I figured out how to do. And so right as I was kind of realizing that I had to wrap it up, I did a Kickstarter. I thought like we can really make this work. And then I had my second child and I had a second job at that point at MoveOn. And I just was like, I can't make this go. So I like offered everyone a refund from the Kickstarter. And I had a little team and paid out the staff and wrapped it up. And basically exactly at that moment, podcasts exploded. AirPods were released. Everyone started listening to that kind of audio all the time. Right when I wrapped, the thing that became Pod Save America launched, which was called Keeping It 1600 at that time. Mm-hmm. And they did exactly what I had dreamed of doing. So I'm very glad that they're out there in the world, and I've done other things with my life.
I spoke to Dan Pashman earlier this year, actually, about his podcast. He came through that same generation of Air America that
absolutely.
You did.
Absolutely, yeah.
And he doubled down and eventually, figured out how to make money. But yes. He told a very similar story about how there were these crooks and the money wasn't there. And
Rachel Maddow was part of the starting lineup there.
And Maron.
And Mark Maron. And there were so many. Sam Cedar was there. Yeah. He was co-hosting a show with Janine Garofalo. Yes. Chuck D was co-hosting with Rachel Maddow.
I remember following this trajectory of yours, and actually, I want to go all the way back because, As I mentioned to you when I came in, we're sitting in a house that I was in once before in the near west side of Madison, Wisconsin, where you live now.
Yes.
We both grew up in this neighborhood. I know you from when we were kids. Your sister was a year ahead of me in school. I was aware of you for most of, I think, your life, much of my life.
Yep.
And I was reminded that I was here once when you were, I guess, back from college. We went to the same high school. You went to Harvard. I stayed in Madison. You had my email address, I guess. I received this invitation from you.
Yeah.
Which was not really something that I was so accustomed to having happen, that somebody I sort of knew went off to college and came back and then invited me to hear some presentation or something that they wanted to share. And it stands out to me as a memory, even though this is maybe 30 years ago. You had started to explore activism and you had started public service to a degree. Remind me of what that was and what you were doing.
Well, I'll tell you the story of that moment.
Okay.
But that moment, it goes back a lot further than that in terms of, this state, Wisconsin, is this incredible, the most fertile imaginable soil for people who want to be part of fights to change the world. So I feel like this story really starts in Madison. But when I was in college, I wanted to be part of something to make the world better and started learning about the global AIDS crisis, which at the time was just exploding completely out of control. And AIDS treatment had just become potentially mm-hmm. something that was affordable to provide to people around mm-hmm. the world. Mm-hmm. There were companies in India that were doing generic AIDS drug manufacturing. The Clinton Foundation had just negotiated this huge price cut for AIDS drugs in the global south. And I met a group of activists who'd been involved in the U.S. AIDS movement and ACT UP, and then started a group called the Health Gap Coalition to try to tackle the AIDS crisis globally. Some friends and I started this activist group to try to get the U.S. to do the right thing and help lead the world to tackle the AIDS crisis. And that's how I met my wife. And then we started emailing everyone we knew across the country at campuses to try to launch other chapters. It became a national campaign called the Student Global AIDS Campaign. And that's what brought me to be about 10 feet from where we're talking right now here in this house, trying to help launch the Wisconsin chapter of the Student Global AIDS Campaign.
I appreciate that you say it goes back to Wisconsin. Before we go all the way back to Wisconsin, it goes back to you in high school. I remember, first of all, that I had been writing for the newspaper, the original alternative high school newspaper, and you out-alternatived me after I graduated by starting your own alternative newspaper, which was political and funny and provocative. So you were already experimenting with or playing with being funny and being serious at the same time. You used humor as a way to provoke and to move the dial.
So this is this deep tradition in Madison specifically, going back to the 70s, this prank culture at the University of Wisconsin. There's the Pail and Shovel Party at the university, and then the 10 Fat Tigers Party, and the Onion started, kind of people coming out of the university. I grew up on the Onion, obsessed with it, starting in the 80s before it became everything it later became.
Yes.
I should also say, my mom's best friend was a woman named Ada Deer, who was this amazing Native American leader who then ran for Secretary of State in the 70s. I was born in 81. When I was 11, she ran for Congress.
Yes.
And so I volunteered on her campaign. That was my first campaign I ever volunteered on. She won her primary, and she was from the Menominee tribe and had led this effort to get the federal government to re-recognize her tribe after it had terminated recognition. Mm-hmm. So she was known as this Menominee leader. And the night she won her congressional primary, she started her speech by saying, "I've been waiting a long time to say this, me nominee," which was like perfect joke. So I had the kind of sense that you could use humor in politics maybe started there for me. But then in middle school, inspired by The Onion, my friends and I started the Hamilton Free Press, which was our underground middle school comedy political student newspaper. Mm-hmm. And then we got to West and we launched a new paper called The Yellow Press my sophomore year.
Yeah.
And that became, we wound up making it a citywide paper and got involved in supporting the teachers union against the school administrators and campaigning against corporate sponsorship of school events that turned the school into a marketing agency for Coca-Cola.
Right. Staged a walkout?
We did walkouts about various things. Yeah. The environmental Earth Day walkouts. Yeah. Earth Day started in Wisconsin. Yeah. We ultimately organized students from around the state to go to the state legislature and testify about school funding formula, because so many of the things we were concerned about came down to the fact that the state was starving schools of resources, which Republicans turned into an art form under Scott Walker and have continued to do to this day. We had this experience of a thing that started as just a fun hobby turning into this statewide campaign that made news all over the state and helped affect statewide laws. And it was this real sense, and all these adults were totally supportive of these kids leaving school to go down to the Capitol and testify. And it was this real sense of you can actually do something.
Yes. It's interesting that you say the adults were supportive of it, because I suppose that may speak to the Wisconsin idea and the Wisconsin tradition. We'll support it. And as a matter of fact, we encourage it.
Yeah.
And we almost expect that the next generation will pick up this fight. Sounds totally normal as you describe it to me, but maybe is kind of unique.
I don't think that's normal across the country.
Yeah.
I will say, one time we had this idea of starting an underground student newspaper association.
Yeah.
So we searched around for where were the other underground student newspapers. Yeah. And what we found was students had started an underground newspaper and then they all got expelled. It was not a normal thing that you could have this kind of relationship. Sometimes the administrators didn't like what we were writing or saying and we got in some trouble. But at the same time, they took us seriously in a way that I think is the right way for adults to be, to take teenagers seriously and to actually listen to what they have to say and not expect them only to be concerned with their very specific lives, but have broader concerns. And if you look right now, my kids get to see students at West and East and all these Madison schools, organizing walkouts to go to the Capitol and protest ICE and to be genuinely involved in the affairs of the state. And that's, I think, what it means to have a kind of civil society is for it to be an expectation that people will be active citizens and to have avenues for that to happen. And for people, sometimes they screw up, sometimes they get things wrong, but that's just part of learning how to be a citizen. And that's I feel like a real gift that it was in the water here and not a lot of other places and really shaped me.
You lived in DC and in New York and had kids in both?
So my wife and I, she went to grad school in the Boston area and then we moved to New York. We got pregnant in Cambridge, Mass, and then Mac arrived in New York, and then Susie and Jack arrived in DC.
In your experience of having lived, you know, with the family in those three environments, plus Boston, four, I guess, do you get the sense that it's easier, that there, it's more accessible to sort of engage in the civil society that you describe in Madison?
I think so, yeah. I think so. There are amazing families and schools and all kinds of people all over, you know, every place in the country.
Yeah.
But in DC, there's a real sense like this place is run fundamentally not by the people of DC. It's DC is like ultimately overseen by the federal government. And New York is this enormous system. And there's, you know, all kinds of kids doing mind-blowing stuff in New York. But also no one really has the sense that they're helping shape the course of events there. Like it's just such a giant place. I wasn't a parent in Cambridge, so I didn't get to experience it the same way. But I think Madison is really unusual in the way that it celebrates kids and young people. And like right now, as we speak, one of my kids is in a young Shakespeare players rehearsal, which is like they make it economically possible for anyone to do it. Full-length Shakespeare plays performed in their entirety by kids 8 to 18. Mm. That's one of many things like that within walking distance of where I'm sitting right now. And that's just amazing. Yeah. It's such a great, and it makes, gives kids the sense that they can create things and make things happen. There was a study by the economist Raj Chetty of basically looking at census tracts across the country and how they affected people's ability to have social mobility in their lives. And Madison's in the top five in the country of places that have that quality. Mm. It's something where kids can, you know, find a new path for themselves. And obviously, you know, not everyone has the same opportunities.
Sure.
And I had enormous privilege. My parents were academics and have been very lucky in an enormous number of ways. But one of the biggest ways that I feel lucky is to have grown up here in Wisconsin and here in Madison.
Talking about the tradition that you started to engage with, I love that you talk about how you're obsessed with The Onion and then that you started the
Hamilton Free Press.
Positions you perfectly for what ended up happening when you went to Boston. You ended up connecting with Al Franken. I don't know how far into your college career you were when that happened.
It was what would have been my last semester of college.
Uh-huh.
So his daughter was a student there.
Uh-huh.
He got a fellowship at the Shorenstein Center for Press and Politics and came for a semester and started a study group. And the topic of the study group was how to research my book.
Yes.
And so he brought me on and I wound up kind of leading the research team and I decided to take the semester off. So I wound up working more or less full time as his right hand he was writing the book and I was helping kick in jokes and research. And
did you recognize something in each other? I mean, did he spot you and understand this kid gets me? Did you know I have what you need? I know how to help you.
I had been a long time fan. He'd written this book, Rush Limbaugh's A Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations, that was really a book that was part of a genre that doesn't really exist right now, which is very funny, very political, kind of Democratic or liberal books. And there were a bunch of others by different people, but that was the biggest runaway bestseller and kind of an exemplar of the tradition. And he was doing another book like that. So when I went in to interview with him, I was one of the first people that he interviewed for his research team. And after like 5 minutes, he was like, oh, wait, so you like Paul Krugman? And I was writing for The Onion by this time, I should say.
You're writing for The Onion. And you also are a Midwest transplant to the East Coast.
Yeah, just like he grew up in Minnesota. Yeah. And so he was like, okay, you're hired.
Yeah.
And then he was like, wait, I'm not supposed to hire people during the interviews. Like, don't tell anyone. So there was like a kind of, record scratch, keep this under your hat. But we clicked very quickly. And I had this, I love bringing these different things together. If you look at sort of what I've done professionally, it zigzagged between advocacy around issues that affect people directly. I was very involved in the fight against healthcare repeal, for example, and work on school funding and workers' rights, these different things. So that's one piece. Second piece is politics and who holds office and, you know, elections and campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third is media communication and humor.
Yes.
And so you can sort of pinball between those three things and I try to find ways to combine them in different ways. But that was true all the way growing up. That was true of what I did in college. And then suddenly they all kind of fused with the chance to work with him on a book that was going to be comedy focused on who was in office and the media and how it shaped the politics that affect people's lives. Mm-hmm. So it's like perfect for me.
And the book ends up coming out. It's called Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them.
Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, A Fair and Balanced Look at the Right.
Which was really a response to Fox in a lot of ways, right?
So their slogan was Fair and Balanced. He didn't know what the book was going to be called. So we had this 13-person research team, and he told us all that whoever came up with a title for the book, he would take out to dinner at a fancy restaurant. And one of the other research team members and I came up with the title and subtitle combo together, which worked perfectly together.
So you got appetizers and dessert, and your friend took us both out,
which is great. I think Beth came, my now wife. Part of the backstory here was that when I started working with him, I'd already had three other big projects that I was working on, mm-hmm. and I just went into like a work frenzy. And after a while, Beth and I had been dating for a few months at that point, and she broke up with me because I was being
unavailable,
not a good boyfriend.
Yeah.
So then I was like, wait a minute. I love this one. And so I like wrapped up everything except my work with Al and told Al that I could only work with him at times when she wasn't available to hang out with me. And so we started working on the book and timed around her classes. And then he would walk with me to where her class was so that I could greet her as she left the class. And he would like wave to her and then walk away. And I'd walk her to her next class, trying to get her to go back out with me again, which eventually did work out. And now we're married and have three kids. So
he helped in some ways.
Yeah. She's mentioned in both Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them a Fair Amount, Look at the Right, I think. And then definitely she's like a character in the next book, The Truth with Jokes, that I worked with him on.
Was there a sense after you finished school then that whatever he was going to do next, you would go with him? Or at what point did you decide, oh, I think I'm going to continue this work?
So I took off what would have been my last semester of college. Yeah. And he like wrote in the acknowledgments of the book, Ben, like, great working with you. And to your parents, Ben will finish college.
Yeah.
And so I went back to school. The subtitle of the book, A Fair and Balanced Look at the Right, wound up being this perfect bait because Bill O'Reilly, who was one of the kind of Fox News characters on the cover of the book, freaked out at Al. Al like went after him for all his lies.
Yeah.
That chapter I was proud to help research on. And Bill O'Reilly convinced Fox News Channel to sue Al Franken over the copyright violation supposedly in the subtitle of the book.
Fair and Balanced,
which is obviously protected satire.
Yeah.
But that lawsuit rocketed the book to number one bestseller status before it even came out, and it wound up being an explosive bestseller. So Al was on this massive book tour, and I went back to school for the final semester in my year 4.5 or whatever as a super senior. And at the time, I thought maybe I would go try to work on the 2024 presidential race.
Mm-hmm.
2004. Yeah. Yes, 20 years ago. 22 years ago.
Yeah.
So that was my theory in the fall of 2003. But then this Air America idea came together, and he became the kind of marquee launch host. And then I just worked with him really closely on this book, and he asked me to join him. So that became the game plan.
You mentioned earlier that the books that Al was writing were part of a genre, a style, a trend of books at the time that we don't see so much anymore. You know, I thought when you said that, are we also just missing that approach to humor when we're talking about politics today? And if so, does that speak to the severity of the moment? Is it just books are not the best mode of communication today?
It's interesting. I have puzzled over this. So I wrote a book, which is coming out in July.
That's part of what we're doing here.
my goal is to try to help bring some of that energy back.
Yeah.
Back, if you go back to the George W. Bush days in the 2000s, Jon Stewart and The Daily Show was this massive thing, and then The Colbert Report came out and was this massive
thing. In some ways, I would imagine The Colbert Report was part of this trolling of Bill O'Reilly.
Absolutely.
And had to have been in some ways influenced by some of this work that you guys were doing.
The Colbert Report character was Bill O'Reilly.
Yes.
Like, it was very done on. The Al Franken show, the original name of the show was The O'Franken Factor, which was a joke based on the O'Reilly Factor. Yeah. And it was just a tweak and annoy Bill O'Reilly because he was so baitable. There was also like Michael Moore and his movies, and he had this book Stupid White Men that was a giant hit.
Yes.
And like, yeah, you know, there were a number of these different things. And then Obama came in, and the energy kind of seeped away, and it was more of the sense of like, I don't know, that when you have a Democratic president, it's very hard to sustain kind of like broadly Democratic activism in that way.
Mm.
And the same thing happens in reverse. Like the conservative movement wound up sort of fizzling after George W. Bush's second term. And I think MAGA's fizzling right now in Trump's second term. So there's a kind of slosh of the washtub of political momentum in that sense. But then when Trump came in, a lot of comedians said he's beyond parody. Like it's so dark, and he's such a like kind of a evil clown in the way that he shows up in the world that it's actually harder to do things that have that kind of like funny a little bit above it all.
It's just such a tidal wave of crazy.
Yeah.
So it's hard to know what would be funnier or more ridiculous than him.
It's true. And I mean, my response to this, my book is fundamentally not about Trump. Yeah. It takes it as a given that we're in this kind of dystopian political hellscape that we are. Yeah. And it's about how do we fight back and get out of this. Yes. And it talks a lot about all the other levels of government, which add up to the political system that allows something like the Trump administration to happen. And that's, you know, I think Al Franken's work took a similar vein, went after right-wing media. And I think and The Daily Show often, and the Colbert Report were often satire of conservative media rather than a satire of George W. Bush himself.
Yes. Because
obviously, there were a lot of very hacky books about all his malapropisms and stuff. But it wasn't, that wasn't centrally what was interesting.
Right.
And it feels to me like there's an enormous kind of unmined territory out there right now in this age of Tucker Carlson. And I guess Elon Musk kind of has a Trumpian quality this way, because he's already so lame in trying to be funny and so horrible in the ways that he's awful for the world.
Yeah.
And he's a little bit beyond satire in that sense. But it does feel like I think we should bring it back. And if you go to like a No Kings protest, there are hilarious signs everywhere. Like, this is the thing that's one thing that I find generally infuriating is this idea on the right that somehow, you know, comedy became illegal on the left because you couldn't be politically incorrect and blah, blah, blah. And in fact, the vast majority of comedians and comedy writers and the funniest, you know, people doing the funniest work are people who have, you know, fundamentally like liberal and progressive values.
Sure.
And they might actually be working professionally in comedy and not doing the like kind of weak sauce comedy-esque Fox News show that Greg Gutfeld hosts on Fox News Channel.
Right.
It's like the people who can't actually hack it in comedy wind up being conservative comedians. So I encourage anyone out there who's involved professionally in comedy to think about how to use your powers for good.
Well, okay, so this also then brings us to, you know, one of the things that happens with Franken after being on Air America, as we know, is that he decides to pursue a political career. I mean, were you part of the conversation with him when he decided to pivot?
Yeah, I remember those conversations vividly. And there were people in Minnesota who were encouraging him to run. There's a big part of the book, The Lies and Lying Liars, was about Norm Coleman, who's this Republican who had come in essentially on the strength of misrepresentations about what happened at Paul Wellstone's memorial service. And Paul Wellstone had been a dear friend of Al's. And that was kind of the emotional heart of the book, was telling that story. And so Al, you know, decided to move home to Minnesota and think about whether he might run. He moved at the beginning of 2006, and that year, Beth had a fellowship that was taking her to D.C., and my plan was to follow her to D.C., and then at the last second, I got really excited about Sherrod Brown's U.S. Senate race, so I moved to Ohio and worked on Sherrod Brown's race initially instead, and then wound up back in D.C. and proposing to Beth the next spring, and, you know, the rest is our family history. But I'm sort of drawn like a moth to the flame of wherever I feel like I can have the biggest impact on things that I am, you know, think are important or I'm infuriated by, or, you know, whatever's kind of feels like the lever where you can try to create change for the better. And Air America felt like that place in those days of George W. Bush.
Yep.
But part of me also was like, maybe I should be working on a campaign. Like I said, and then by the midterm, by 2006, it really felt like we have to win a chamber of Congress, at least, and Democrats wound up winning both.
Yep.
And then I went to work for an advocacy group. So I worked on issues for a number of years after that. But there was part of me that was always like, I should be, you know, focusing more on the electoral side. Yeah. I did a lot of work on climate change and different kinds of issues. So that's like the zigzag. There's a piece of career advice that I now have learned as part of there's a Japanese philosophy of living well called Ikigai, I think it's called, which is like, do something that you love doing, that you think is important, that you can do well, and that ideally can also like put food on your table. And finding things at the intersection of that, I think a lot of the early part of a career is figuring out what meets all those things.
Mm.
And when I did the podcast, I couldn't figure out how to put food on the table with it.
I don't think I've always followed that. I think I forget sometimes to check all the boxes. You were at MoveOn.
Mm-hmm.
What, a founder?
So MoveOn started in 98, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it started, the original name of MoveOn was Censure and Move On, related to Bill Clinton. And MoveOn, it was like, let's, you know, move past this.
Get past this.
And it was this explosively viral online petition. And then they were like, all these people signed the petition and are saying, what do we do next? And they're like, well, let's help win the next election. Yeah. And so they sort of invented online donations to politics. All these things came out of MoveOn. When I was at Air America, MoveOn was really important in the fight against the Iraq War and helping mobilize for the 2004 presidential election. So I booked MoveOn leaders on the Al Franken show a lot. And that's when I met the MoveOn crew.
Yeah.
who are now some of my closest friends Eli, in the world. Eli Pariser, yeah. Tom Matzy, Elise Hoag, yeah. and a bunch of other folks.
All have at times been extremely active in my email inbox.
Yes. So then I went to work for a group called Avaaz, which yes. is sort of like a global move on. But I went over and helped move on in the final stretch in the 2008 presidential race. Yep. So I spent several months there helping organize people actually to do something that came up again a lot when I became the chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, which was working to help people who didn't live in swing states go to swing states to help volunteer to help Obama win.
Yes.
It was called the Travelers Program. So I sort of learned a lot about online organizing and plugged in there. Avaaz was kind of co-founded by Move On and another group called the Res Publica. So Move On, the Move On and Avaaz worlds were pretty intertwined. My life intersected much more with Move On when they sponsored my podcast. And then after a bit, they were like, asked me to be the Washington, D.C. director for Move On. So I was in charge of their advocacy around the federal government.
Like, yes.
And that's when I actually landed there full time.
In every great myth, the hero leaves home and then and then returns at some point. Did you have it in your mind that you maybe were eventually going to come home?
Well, I will distinguish myself from any mythic hero. I always wanted to raise my kids in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
From the first date I had with Beth, I was like telling her about this amazing place and what a great place to raise kids. And I'm not sure if I phrased it as like, we should have kids in Madison together, but it was like, I just love this place. So at every kind of juncture in our lives, this was like, hey, is this a good time to move back to Wisconsin?
Yeah.
It never made sense for one reason or another until 2018.
By the way, I interviewed you on a panel in 2018.
That's right.
And you said something. I mean, I just have a vague sense memory of you saying, we would meet in Madison tomorrow if we could figure out a way to do it, or if there were work for us or there were opportunity. You had already planted that seed in 2018.
We almost moved at the beginning of that year, and then we were like, wait, we don't actually know how we would do this.
Yeah.
So it was like, then we sort of decided we would figure it out by the end of the year. And by the end of the year, we had made a plan where I was going to keep working remotely for Move On.
Uh-huh.
And my job changed from DC director to senior advisor. Mm-hmm. And they were good with me, you know, focusing on things other than like, you know, dealing with members of Congress and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And Beth was going to look for a job when we got here.
Mm-hmm.
That was our game plan. And it didn't go that way at all, which we can get to in a second. But yeah, I just love this place. The different places that I lived just made me love it and appreciate it more. And then there was this other thing, which is that this place that I'd grown up, that I grew up just relishing in the tradition of the progressive movement in Wisconsin, the capital P progressive movement. This is the state that created Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and unemployment insurance and workers' compensation and public radio and Earth Day, and was the first state to have statewide laws against discrimination against women and LGBTQ people and people with disabilities, and like all these big steps forward for the country had come from this state. But when I was growing up, I hadn't really tuned into the fact that there was also this very, very right-wing strain in the state's history. And while I was away, that strain took over. Scott Walker came in, you know, going back to Joe McCarthy, and some of the progressives who did all the kinds of great stuff were also hideous eugenicists and racists. Like, there were some really rough sides to the state's history. And suddenly, the state that had been this kind of celebrated bastion of the progressive movement became one of the most red states in the country in terms of our policies, passed the most restrictive voting law in the country, passed the most gerrymandered partisan maps in the entire country, passed this very aggressive anti-union legislation that led to the biggest decline in union density in the country in the 21st century. It looked for a bit like it might just be becoming a permanently red state. And so when we moved back, one of the questions that we didn't know the answer to was, were we moving back to a state that was actually going to be a place where our kids would not grow up feeling like they could be part of creating positive political change the way that I had? Is this actually a state that was just going to go the way of like Indiana or Ohio? Maybe Iowa's coming back at this point, but it seemed like Iowa had also gone way over to the red side. Florida had been a really purple state like Wisconsin.
And also, this is, I was trying to find the tie to Trump's first election, but of course, Wisconsin became one of the few crucial places in the country that could determine the outcome of an election.
So people hadn't, because Obama had won by landslides here, people had forgotten that it was the closest state in the country in 2004, and it was the third closest state in the country in 2000. And so it had been a very purple, battlegroundy state, but Democrats had just managed to edge out the Republicans going all the way back to 1988. And so it felt to me here growing up that it was like, a state that was going to vote for Democrats.
Yeah.
Trump sense an opportunity. The Clinton campaign did not see the danger. The polls were totally off. The polling average right before the election in 2016 had Clinton up by 6.5 points. And the Walker kind of machine and legacy, part of it had been to change the electorate by shutting a lot of people out, and including especially students and African Americans. And so Trump started running ads and then realized, like, hey, I could really pull this off. And if you take the states, if you take them in the 2016 election and line them up by the margin of victory and add up the Electoral College votes in that line, then the state that tips Trump over the top to become the next president of the United States is Wisconsin.
Yes.
It was the tipping point state in that election, which was this, like, mind-blowing, totally—
Did it blow your mind? Were you caught off guard?
Well, I was here knocking on doors, and I was reading the 538, you know, stories and looking at the polling averages, and I thought it must be fine, but it didn't feel fine on the ground. I was knocking on doors in Madison suburbs and talking to people who were telling me conspiracy theories, who were supposed to be the strong Democrats that I was supposed to turn out. Mm. And I was like, I had this cognitive dissonance. And I remember Beth, who's much more able to tune into her surroundings than I am, Beth was like, this doesn't feel good. I don't think this doesn't feel like it's going to work. And I was like, Beth, no, look, the numbers say it's going to be fine. And she was totally right. There was a real sense that there was something amiss on the ground, that now I've learned to listen to that spidey sense. But it was very, very close. But Trump did pull it out, and there were, you know, Trump signs all over the state, and there were not Clinton signs all over the state in the same way. That felt like maybe this is the final nail in the coffin. So by the time we came back in 2018, there was this— I came and volunteered for several months before the election.
Yes.
And it was not clear whether we had a real shot or not, even amidst the blue wave energy. And it wound up being the second closest governor's race in the country was the race of Tony Evers versus Scott Walker.
Yes.
The closest was Ron DeSantis, who won by less than half a point in Florida. Mm. And the second closest was Tony Evers in what was some press outlets called the biggest upset of the night, beating Scott Walker. And that was, in my book, I liken it to, after being pushed off a cliffside, grabbing the last branch and pulling yourself up by your fingernails over the cliff's edge.
Yeah. Well, that's how each of these elections has felt.
Yes.
You know. Did you move with the job then?
No.
You moved—
My MoveOn job.
You moved here with MoveOn.
Yes.
And then you realized that there was an opportunity in the Democratic Party.
Yes. So then the then chair decided not to run for another term and talked to me, sort of floated the idea to me of if she didn't run, what I consider running.
Yeah.
And she didn't know if she was going to run at that time. And a lot of people were thinking about running if she didn't. But I wound up totally upsetting our family's plans. And it was something of a challenge from a family perspective. But I decided to go for it because I felt like all this organizing that I'd learned how to do, both growing up here and then across the country, and the online organizing I'd learned to do at MoveOn and Avaz, and a lot of the communications work that I'd done in my multiple different jobs, it was all stuff that I could use to try to help supercharge this work that thousands of people had been carrying on even when it seemed hopeless in Wisconsin.
Yes.
And I wanted to, like, help support the work that they were doing on the ground.
Yeah.
And so I jumped into the race, and after this whirlwind education, crisscrossing the state, talking to everybody for several months, won the election for chair that June.
I understand you're not a mythological hero, you're a human person, but I do think that there are moments when certain things kind of align. Like, you were at the right stage in your life, you were at the right stage in your family. Like, all there were so many conditions that sort of conspired to make it make sense. There are so many reasons why it maybe wouldn't have made sense for other people. Also, you know, you are a deep Wisconsinite. You know, you are from here. You came from here. And at the same time, you had gone away and you came back. When you came back, were you met with any sort of skepticism? Like, where have you been that you now want to be the chair of the Democratic Party?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there was a lot of that at the beginning of my campaign for chair. And I started telling stories from growing up. Ada Deer wound up driving me to campaign events, like introducing me. She nominated me at the state party convention. Uh-huh. Because I'd been away and I've been doing this, you know, stuff in other places, there was this kind of this question of, like, is this really about Wisconsin? And for me, all the other stuff was about Wisconsin. Like, this, you know, but I think that the best of Wisconsin's politics, the belief that that politics can be a force for good, that you can make government responsive and effective and accountable to regular people and not just, you know, kind of wealthy elites.
Yes.
All that is, those are versions of the Wisconsin idea. The Wisconsin idea is, the phrase is the boundaries of the university or the boundaries of the state. But embedded within that is this idea that the university itself exists to serve the state and to help the state figure out how to actually be effective and make things work. Mm. The University of Wisconsin started this thing called the Legislative Reference Library that was University of Wisconsin experts figuring out what happens if you pass this or that kind of law? Looking across the country, trying to figure out, you know, they set up the first progressive income tax that actually worked in Wisconsin because of the Legislative Reference Library. And the guy who led it for a decade became the architect of Social Security nationally. Mm-hmm. It was this idea of like, you should use the best thinking and the best in a way that's grounded in the public interest to figure out how to make government work. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, really at the core of what I see the job of politics to do, is to serve people and actually work.
So this is where we're heading. You know, I mean, you are a kind of antidote, just your energy is a kind of antidote to what the way I feel. Like, this speaks to my privilege and the bubble that I grew up in, but I don't think I ever really understood what it felt to be completely defeated and hopeless. I've really lost any sense of who I am. My entire sense of identity was challenged. And I can only imagine that you suffer from some of this sometimes too, but you always have seemed to at least maintain a sense of, it's not over yet. We have a lot of positive work we can do. Because I often ask myself, what is the plan? What can we do? And then I learn that you've written this book, as I understand it, called This Is the Plan.
Yes.
How to End America's Meltdown and Save Democracy. Do you believe that there's hope for us to somehow get out of this?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I also want to say, it can also get worse. It can always get worse and it can always get better. And that those two things are the two things I kind of carry with me, one in each pocket. That as bad as things seem, you know, if you look through American history, if you look through the history that different communities have had, even at times that are remembered by other communities as being great, including, you know, 800 years Menominee tribe, like in the 50s when the time that Trump seems to want to make America great, like, or maybe it's the 80s.
Yeah.
Her tribe was terminated. Recognition was terminated. The only hospital closed. The schools kind of fell apart. Like things, there have been times when it felt like the world was ending for different parts of this country, all the way back to, you know, well before our founding. And at every moment, as well as the possibility that things could go even more south, there's always been some kind of path to make things better. And it always takes regular people deciding that they're going to be part of that fight and refusing to give up and figuring out, you know, even if you can't change everything at once, what is the fight where you can move the needle enough to open the door to the next thing? And when I think about the path that we've taken politically in the state of Wisconsin, that's the model, I think, for where we are as a country, which is, if you look at Wisconsin in 2018, beginning of that year, it was more dominated by the far right than the entire United States is now. Mm-hmm. And we had a governor with Scott Walker, with a Supreme Court that went around retroactively kind of legalizing his lawbreaking and rewriting all the laws to make Absolutely. It impossible for, you know, for other people to be able to take power, all these things. And it felt like
that we see on a national level.
That we see on a national level. Yeah. It was like a preview for the, you know, Project 2025 was what Walker put in place in Wisconsin. And as it turned out, Trump lost in 2020, and we could, you know, felt like, oh, yes. Well, we got through that. Thank goodness.
Exactly.
But as it turned out, that was nowhere close to enough because, you know, there's so many things that have been stacked up. The things that made Trump's ascent possible in the first place were still there. And you have to go a lot deeper than just winning the White House if you want to dictator-proof this country, if you want to have a future of responsive government and of democracy and of opportunity for everybody where people's, you know, most basic freedoms are respected. You have to fight for every level of government. And in Wisconsin, the only way that we got out to where we are now, where we actually have a kind of effective, free and fair electoral system with fair maps in our legislature, involved winning the state Supreme Court.
So yeah. When you came, what was your order of operations to try to attack this problem?
So I was elected and I laid out my plan. It was spelled WISCO. And my plan was win the 2020 Supreme Court election, use that as a dress rehearsal for the November election. Then we had the national convention here that summer, we thought, before COVID. So the I in WISCO was inspire, recruit, and train thousands of volunteers at the national convention. S was save the veto by stopping a Republican supermajority in the legislature, which was the best thing we could hope for at that time. There's no chance of getting majorities. C was cancel Trump's second inaugural, which I was a phrase that I'm really pleased that I went for because it's not enough to win the presidential election. You also have to make the election actually take effect, which turned out to be a big thing.
Yeah.
And then the O was organized for the long term. So that was like the first 2-year plan. At that time, it seemed like there were several possible paths to preventing the supermajority or to getting fair maps in Wisconsin, which we knew the only if we won fair maps in the legislature could we have a chance of actually changing the laws that had rigged the state so much. There was a federal lawsuit. There was the governor could veto Republicans when they tried to pass the next round of gerrymandered maps after 2020, or we could win the state Supreme Court. But then the first two pads over time closed off. I tell the story in my book of how that happened. Mm-hmm. So the Supreme Court became the only way to do it. And in order for even that to work, we'd have to reelect Governor Evers in 2022 and stop supermajorities again in 22. And then 2023 became the battle royale where we had this chance. And that became the most expensive judicial election in American history. After we won, the Republicans decided to impeach the new justice before she started doing her job to prevent her from being able to strike down the map. So there was another battle, which we had a whole campaign called Defend Justice to stop them. But finally, after all that, then we got fair maps at last. And in 2024, even though Trump won, and it was a nightmarish year in many respects, it was also this watershed year for Democrats in the Wisconsin legislature. Democrats won 10 assembly seats and 4 state Senate seats, more than any other state, bigger gains than Democrats in any other state, and opened the door to, now this year, the potential for Democrats to win a majority in the state assembly and the state Senate and have a trifecta, win the governor's race again, and then be able to pass laws to actually make this state a thriving democracy for everybody.
So given all of these successes, one would consider that it would be a rational and logical next step to apply the same thinking to the National Democratic Party. And you did campaign and run to be the chair of the National Democratic Party. How did that campaign play out?
I had not had a plan to run for Democratic National Committee chair. And my plan was that Harris was going to win. And then the president...
I think a lot of people had that plan.
That was the plan.
Yeah.
So I was spent every second trying to make that happen. And we came... In Wisconsin, we were the closest state in the country. And we were had the smallest swing to the right of any battleground state. Mm. But... Trump won here by less than 1 percentage point, and nationwide it was a 6-point swing to the right. So it didn't work. Trump went back in, and after that, my phone started blowing up, and people were like, "You should run for DNC chair." And my wife and I kind of took some long walks, and we're like, "We don't know what this is going to do to our family or how this is going to work, but it feels like we're teetering into a really nightmarish scenario," which in ways that I feel like now have played out. So we decided, I was going to run for DNC chair.
Yeah.
And what I learned pretty quickly is that the one of the core principles that I tried to apply in Wisconsin is true in DNC elections as well, which is you can't show up 2 months before an election and expect to earn trust with an electorate. You actually have to be present year over year, building relationships with people. And, Harris talks a lot in her book about how hard it was to run for president with a 107-day campaign.
Yes.
And I jumped in the race, but already Ken Martin, who's now the DNC chair, in a way, as the leader of the State Chairs Association, he'd been building relationships with the state chairs around the country and laying a groundwork for years. And so even though when I called DNC members around the country, they're like, "All these ideas sound great," but they know Ken Martin. He's been present. He's been coming to their states and speaking at their dinners and knocking on doors with them. And I think in retrospect, the die was cast probably before I decided to jump in the race. We got a ton of support, and I'm grateful to everyone who endorsed all the grassroots organizations that I'd partnered with over the years, came into support. We had a ton of elected officials and came in second. But this is a race with 428, 435, I forget the exact number, voters. And they are people who have spent years often in the Democratic Party in some way. And a lot of them had been in the trenches with Ken Martin and this or that fight years before, and where I'd been focused on Wisconsin.
Yeah.
He'd really been investing himself in this body, and members of the body were like, "Yep, let's go with this guy."
As you said, you've had this kind of diverse set of interests, and you pivot according to where you think you might be the most useful, what will provide for you, whatever. So, you've got this book coming out, which I haven't read, but I'm optimistic that it is a return to some of your love of being funny and also being serious. I don't know. Are you funny in the book?
I deploy humor in the book.
Humor is deployed. Right. Which is something I wanted to ask you about Franken. Was there a sense that when he became a senator, when he became a serious politician, that he had to find the right balance of funny versus serious? When you're a public servant, when you're a representative, are you allowed to be as funny as you want to be? Do you have to rein it in more?
He, in his campaign, wound up turning it down a lot. And his first term, he, as he later wrote, he had the dehumorizer, and everything had to go through the dehumorizer. And then when he was reelected, he was the closest race in the country in 2008. Yeah. He won by 312 votes. There was a 6-month recount. It was this giant battle. But he really earned the trust of his constituents that he was there. He was serious. He was there to fight for them.
Yeah.
And because he'd been a professional comedian, that was the bar that he had to clear, was he actually serious about anything?
Yeah.
And he showed he was. So then he could actually come out with his humor. He wrote a book called Giant of the Senate after his reelection in 2014. That was a very, very funny book. And, he grilled Jeff Sessions and hearings, and without getting into everything that came afterwards, I think he kind of brought all those pieces of himself to the work more as he spent more time in the Senate. I think for just about everyone else, I don't think there's any other former professional full-time comedians who became national celebrities as comedians in politics that I can think of. So for everyone else, there's actually a lot more room to be funny.
Hi, friends. I'm interrupting the episode with a brief disclosure before we hear the end of our conversation. Ben's microphone dropped out at this moment of the interview. Fortunately, we live in the age of benevolent robots. At least they tell me that they are benevolent. So I used an AI audio restoration tool to bring his side of the conversation back to life. If you are a close personal friend of Ben's, you may notice that his speech sounds just slightly like an exceptionally well-informed clone. But the conversation was too good to lose, so here are the final few minutes with a little technological assistance.
I mean, at the risk of revisiting this whole woke conversation, it does seem that because, you know, the situation is very serious, and also there's such a concern about accidentally or inadvertently or intentionally offending anybody, that it seems like the MAGA movement somehow did use their version of humor to their advantage, where I think we have had a harder time being fun. It's hard to be funny in serious times, you know?
Figuring out how to like get this right is a challenge, but I think at this point, Trump world has knotted itself in this kind of, there's a kind of political correctness of MAGA now, where the kind of like obsession with stomping out wokeness and stomping out DEI and all this kind of stuff has created a world where the right has tied itself in these kind of ludicrous knots in order to appear based, as they phrase it, which I think is very ripe for disruptive comedy. And they're the ones who are trying to like trample free speech on campuses across the country. And they're the ones that are banning, you know, federal grants to science programs that might research people's gender identity or what have you. Like they're the ones obsessed with trying to restrict people's personal lives. If you think everyone should be able to be who they want to be, I think it's time to go on offense. And I think there's a way to do that. Yeah, that doesn't involve like bullying kids or whatever that the right wants to claim is the thing that's now off limits. You don't actually have to go there. There's a lot of other stuff you can do with humor and comedy.
I guess part of the reason I bring it up is because having entered into the world of running for offices, one has to assume that at least it's on the table for you in the future that you might want to run for more public office.
Maybe one day. This year I have the book and my obsession is things are going so far south and I'm not on the ballot, but a ton of other people are. And I want people who want this country to work for everybody to win at every level as a member. So I'm going to have the book come out this summer and I'm going to do all I can to help lean into these different fights.
So that thing when people leave elected office and they say, I'm leaving to spend more time with my family, there's a kernel of truth in that when they say that?
It probably depends on the person.
Yeah.
In my case, and I think a lot of people's cases, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because there's, depending on the kind of role that you're in, you just have to drop everything and respond to whatever crisis has happened. And it's no matter what is happening in your personal life, if you're in some types of, well, like public service roles, there's a necessity that has to be your first priority because there are people, so many people that are counting on you to do that. And that's not just political life, obviously, like EMTs and doctors and nurses and members of the armed services. And like, there's so many professions that have this quality of like, if you are serving the public in a position of trust, you have to figure out a way to respond to the thing that is an emergency in front of you. And it's just tough. It's really, you know, I would tell my staff, goal one for me is stay married. Everything else, win every election, like all that stuff is goal number two. And I'm really proud that Beth and I are in a great place, but it was hard. And especially because Wisconsin has so many elections and they're so close.
Yeah.
Closer here than any other state. We're the only state where the last three presidential races came on into less than 1 percentage point. And both of the last two US Senate races, 1 percentage point or less, like everything's on a knife's edge, which means that what you do in the next hour could be the thing that tips everything one way or the other. And being able to actually like slow down and look around a little bit and take the dog an extra long walk with my kiddos has been just great.
It's sort of two threads that have run through this conversation. One is Wisconsin is an amazing special place. Madison is an amazing special place. And the other is if we see what happens here politically as a kind of blueprint for what happens on the national stage. And it sounds to me that part of the argument that you're starting to lay out in the book is based on this experience that you've had here, we can extrapolate certain things on a national level. I don't know if I'm reading that or not. So what is the message Like, what's the takeaway?
To me, the like mythic heroes are the thousands upon thousands of people in every part of Wisconsin, including very Republican areas and very blue areas where Democrats always win, who recognized that they had to be part of something bigger than themselves and just kept on organizing and fighting and finding people in their community, running for local office, who kept the torch lit at the darkest times and then never stopped. The lesson from Wisconsin is that if we unite, if we organize, if we don't give up, we can actually get to a better place than we've ever been.
You know, something that is, I think, a commonality between the sort of media world and the political world, as you describe them, is the relentlessness. I mean, I'm sort of exhausted. Like, having spent most of my professional life in the media world, it's that deadlines are very similar. And even though it's often for ridiculous reasons, not for the future of democracy, but because somebody wants something right now, or there's a deadline or whatever, it's exhausting. Yeah. And what you describe, as you describe it to me, is exhausting. Democracy is exhausting.
It's exhausting until you discover solidarity. Mm. When you find a community of people that share a set of values, that share a vision for what kind of state, community, country we can be,
then
it's self-sustaining. I told stories about my wife Beth about this conversation. She and I fell in love. I fell in love with her, but putting up posters for a protest. And if you knock on doors with somebody, you know, you're walking around, there's a lot of time to talk between voters, undecided voters you might encounter when you're, canvassing or what have you. You can find people who wind up, wanting you to be the best version of yourself, who you admire, not just who they are and how gorgeous they are in the case of my wife, but also just the kind of person they are, what they care about. And people are at their best when they're trying to do something not just for themselves, but to make things better. And I think that's when you think about what makes people fall in love with communities, it's often this sense that people are in it not just for themselves, but for the community itself. To me, rebuilding a better politics in this country is just completely interconnected with rebuilding civic life in this country. And I think there's so many forces that pull us away from each other, that push us into our own little bubbles. And even part of what's so painful about life being unaffordable is that it makes everyone feel like they're on their own hamster wheel trying to be able to catch up so they could make the rent or be able to get an after-school program for their kids so they can finish their workday without their kid being at home alone on a screen. All of that isolates us. But maybe ironically, the only way out of this is for us to break out of that isolation and join together and do this work together. Mm-hmm. And that is where the energy comes from. It unlocks something when you're part of something that's bigger than just survival, to be able to build in a better direction alongside all of the personal responsibility that all of us have and to our families. The sense that we can actually build a community that we're proud of, to me, that's where the energy can sustain itself and actually grow to make things better.
Ben Wickler, thank you for building something bigger than just yourself and for sharing the story with me today. It's a long time coming. I'm so glad to catch up with you.
Thanks so much for taking the time. It was been a pleasure.
There he was, my friends, Ben Wickler. And there it was, my friends, the plan. I'll be back again in your headspace before you know it with another deep dive. Until then, I'll talk to you soon.
This has been a WBGO Studios production. To learn more about WBGO Studios' award-winning podcasts, special concerts, live streams, and more, visit wbgo.org/studios.